are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast is Narendranath Damodaran, Executive Director at Pradhan, one of India's leading NGOs working with marginalized communities in some of the poorest states. In this episode, we speak about the challenges faced by rural communities struggling to cope with the second wave of the pandemic, government and third sector response, and what individuals and donors can do to support. Thank you, Naren, for making time to be a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast.
Thank you, Sudha. Thank you for inviting me here.
So we'll get started with the questions. We know that the situation in India has been very grim for the past 6-7 weeks. And I see the coverage in the global media about the healthcare system in India and how it is struggling or is inadequate in the face of the second wave of the pandemic. However, there has been very little conversation about what is really happening to 65% or 70% of the population that lives in rural India. The scale, the depth of the problem. As an organization that works in the heartlands, in the hinterland, in villages, and amongst marginalized communities, what has been your experience about the impact?
The last time when the pandemic came, and it obviously kind of came as a shock to everybody, but that time it was a fear that it might spread to the rural areas. And then we were kind of bracing for it. But the impact, by the time it reached the rural areas, it kind of waned, and it was predominantly an urban phenomenon. But this time took us by shock, as you said. And this time the pandemic really moved into the rural hinterland. And as everything in this country, when something goes to the rural areas, it kind of goes into a national black box, as it were. The public consciousness of what happens in the rural areas is pretty limited. So there is very limited information on what happens in the larger scenario. So even though currently, as we speak, the numbers are waning, the daily deaths and the daily positivity cases, it is reducing. Yeah. But when it is going to the rural areas, the counting is also limited. So we really do not know. But from our own direct experience from the field, it is rampant in the rural areas this time. And it is actually a very difficult situation right now. As a journal recently called it is a virtual hell out there, as it were. And there are reportages from alternate media. Mainstream media is really not covering it much. But in the alternate media, through personal reporting, etc., one is really able to understand. And we can counter-verify it in our own personal experience.
So the first wave last year, as you mentioned, we saw perhaps the largest migration India had seen since partition. And everyone thought that nothing could be worse than seeing the plight of, you know, migrants trekking for thousands of kilometers in the heat with families, women, children, losing their lives, just trying to get back to their communities. What was the focus last year? And how did you mobilize your workforce, partners and donors to support what was happening last year?
Right. You just reminded me. This is an everlasting image. All our collective consciousness, the picture of hundreds of thousands of people trekking back in the heat of the last summer. I think one will never forget it. And we have equally dismal images from this time, but of another kind. In the initial few days, we were also kind of in a shock. I mean, as the whole country suddenly went into a lockdown. And people started trekking back and really hell broke out. And we were also not sure what was happening. And obviously, in the urban areas, we were also scared, so not stepping out. So we were kind of trying to organize our own lives in the beginning. But then we realized that the rural economy was going into a tailspin because there's a huge influx of returned migrants. And any and all economic activity in the rural areas that was going on all stopped. Any of the government programs that were running, like MG Narega or any other public programs, they all came to a grinding halt. So it was a very difficult situation. People were starving, lots and lots of people just going without food. Fortunately, an organization like us and a very large number of NGOs like us, we have quite a good presence at the grassroots level, that is right in the village, through our community resource persons who are members of our self-help groups or who are members of our community livelihoods programs. So all my colleagues immediately got in touch with them because they are our first line of defense. So we got in touch with them, conveyed to them about the disease, the protocols, and then we asked them to start spreading the word in the village that what is COVID protocol. So our first response was kind of mass scale information, education, communication using multiple means and mostly through mobile phones. And then obviously physically people traveling there, and we had vehicles traveling with announcements and with large posters, etc., kind of informing the community as to what the COVID protocol is and how to keep themselves safe. Then we had all our women community cadre also going around. So this was the first step that we did. And this we did across the 7,000 villages. And we reached out to about 600,000 households. It's about 3 million people, roughly. So that is the kind of scale in which we went. But that was not enough information. We had a large number of people starving. So that was the second big area that we had to get involved in. So one thing we started doing was we started mobilizing resources. We started speaking to our donors. We repurposed our existing monies that we had. We also got fresh resources from a number of donors. So we organized financial resources, then bought up dry rations in big scale and then made it into small packets and distributed to over 200,000 households. That was an important thing to be done because people did not have food at home. And the next, migrants were returning to the villages, and they were obviously not allowed to go into the village because they were coming from the city. So they had to be quarantined. So we immediately got in touch with the local panchayats, the local government public health system, and arranged a large number of quarantine centers. And then we also supplied the basic requirements, and most importantly, food. So we also ran about 350 community kitchens across our project areas where fresh, nutritious food was made. So there were two kinds of people. One was the vulnerable people in the village, the very old or disabled people who did not have other people to look after them. And then we also were regularly in touch with the migrant communities. A large number of them were stuck in their city locations, and they were not able to come back because the public transport was not there. They wanted to get in touch with their relatives. They did not have money. So we were arranging some support for them in the urban areas as well. So there were a series of steps that we took in order to ensure that some sense prevailed. And then obviously we did that for about 4 to 5 months till the kind of the peak came down. And then last but not the least was some kind of livelihood inputs, because that was the time, you know, when the crops were standing in the field. So we had to arrange for large-scale marketing of their farm produce, and so that they were able to get some immediate cash returns with which they were able to invest more money into the next crop. We also arranged soft loans for them for investing into the kharif. One very important area that we got involved in was to restart the MG Narega program, you know, the Mahatma Gandhi Rural Employment Guarantee program, which provides 100 days of wages. We did campaigning not just at the local government level, but also at the national level in order to ensure that the Narega program restarted, because that would have been immediate way of providing cash, you know, ready cash, into the hands of the people, because that is what they needed most urgently in order to survive as well as to invest. One more thing we did was at the national level, a large number of us NGOs got together and formed a national network of civil society organization working on COVID relief. So we called it a Rural Community Response to COVID, RCRC network. And through this network, we actually took up a lot of policy influencing work in terms of providing agriculture assistance, restarting MG Narega.
How different is it in terms of scale and complexity this year? And were you surprised by how quickly the pandemic has engulfed entire communities? I know from news reports that people are struggling actually to respond about actually finding a starting point to trigger that response that is required.
Last time it was a scare that this will spread into the rural areas. And as we experienced, the number of incidences in the rural area was reasonably limited. The people who traveled back from the cities really did not carry the virus into the village. There were cases, but very limited. But this time, maybe because we became very complacent and there were many so-called super spreader events, the states that Pradhan works, mostly in the central and northern belt of the country, the rural health infrastructure is abysmal. And if this pandemic explodes in the village, we'll not be able to combat it. We'll have to just allow it to take its own course. And that is what is happening now. And there are deaths, but it is reported as death due to general seasonal ailments or even typhoid or malaria. So there is a lack of information of exactly what is happening. So whatever is being reported is whatever is, you know, people say. There's no real testing happening. In fact, in some of our project areas, there's no testing happening. Therefore, there's no identification. Therefore, no surveillance or any tracking or any appropriate response. In the rural area, there's a total absence of any support system, as it were. People are kind of feeling as if they have been left handed, nobody to really look at them. There's an inability of the system to respond because there are hardly anything that exists. If there are ambulances, it will not have oxygen. Tests, as I said, are not happening. So frontline, even the doctors, they are doing teleconsultations because the demands on them are also very overwhelming. So at the village level, the presence of the system, as we see, is through the Anganwadi or the ASHA worker, the auxiliary health worker. These are the local people. They're semi-trained, and they're also working under a lot of risk because they're also getting infected. They do not have appropriate protection kits, etc. They're going out of their way, I would say, risking their own well-being and trying to do whatever they can. So at the village level, there is a gap of any support system. And what exists is a lot of fear and people with all kinds of half-baked ideas, superstitions, stigma, and a lot of fear, as I said, about getting tested or even going to the doctor or even going to the hospital. Yeah. The universal statement that we hear in our villages is we will not go to the hospital because we have not seen anybody come back from the hospital. So we do not want to go there. Yeah. We do not want to get tested because, quote, God forbid we become positive, we will be ostracized. And, you know, if somebody falls dead, the dead body also will not be given to us. And even at the stage of death, we'll not have dignity. There is fear about vaccination. They've seen people who have got vaccinated and also have got infected.
What I'm hearing from you, Naren, is that there is no concerted effort from the administration, whether it is testing or whether it is hospitalization, etc. They're all struggling with it. What are you doing as Pradhan to support your communities? And what does it mean to go into this knowing that the infrastructure resources are likely to continue to undermine your efforts?
Yes, I could start with saying what are we trying to do. This time also, we were taken by a little bit of surprise and shock because if you looked at February, the number of infections were of the order of 4,000, 5,000. And suddenly, by April, it had become 80,000. In the next month, it went up to 400,000. So the growth curve was so steep that it kind of came like a tsunami. And now it is spread to the villages. And it is kind of spread so badly that we do not even know what to do. What also happened this time was the number of infections inside the organization in Pradhan itself was very high. A lot of my colleagues got infected. Unfortunately, one of my very senior colleagues, he succumbed to the disease. So the organization itself was seriously affected. Our people in the field, a lot of them got affected. Our frontline workers from the self-help groups and the community cadre, a lot of them also got affected. So our own response was slow because, you know, first we had to obviously take care of the well-being of our own people. So we did spend a lot of time trying to create the protocols and trying to provide the support, assistance, and also dealing with just the disease itself, helping them hospitalize. But now we have kind of organized our lives in a way. And now we are also realizing the seriousness of what is happening in the village. So our interventions will be at multiple levels. First, obviously, is to give the people in the village a sense that there is somebody who can talk to, give them a feeling of confidence, and also then making them receptive to any new ideas that are coming in. Because currently what exists is, as I said, fear and stigma. In that space, we need to have confidence and receptivity. My colleagues are regularly in touch with the village people. We are obviously not going there, but through phones and through the community cadre, we're trying to instill some confidence in the villages. If you break it down, it's not a very serious disease to deal with. 85-90% of the people do not need to get hospitalized. A lot of things that you can contain at the village level. So containment is our immediate strategy. It's also important to contain locally because that is what will help us reduce load on the already overloaded health system, where the number of doctors or beds or equipments or anything is so limited that it cannot take care of large number of people coming into the hospital system. So we need to contain them at the rural areas itself. Therefore, what we need is mass-scale education of the people. So what we're doing is we're trying to create videos and training modules, trying to reach out to as many of our self-help group members and community members as possible to provide them proper information on what is the second wave. Obviously, this is a slightly more infectious strain, but we can deal with it. It is possible to deal with it, provided you follow the basic protocols itself. So that is very important. And since the infection rates are much higher this time, it's very important for people to identify from the very early stage, the day of you're getting infected. So this identification of the symptoms and understanding the disease itself is very important. How does one isolate oneself? Suppose we start showing symptoms. But if you're showing symptoms, then there are certain things that you need to do. This is the way you need to isolate. And what we started doing, if people are not able to isolate themselves in their homes, which obviously is the best thing to do, but in the rural areas, in our villages, it is not possible because, you know, in a given household, there are four or five people, the small children, and there are animals, and there are one or two rooms. So that is not possible for people to stay away from each other. So we need to maybe create community facilities, rent or take over a school, which is anyway closed. So take a panchayat building or a government building. Equip it with beds, with the basic amenities, water, and the basic hygiene, masks, sanitizers, etc. And then housing those people there. You need to have separate rooms for women, for men, for early mild symptoms, moderate symptoms. So it's kind of a little more involved this time compared to the basic quarantine centers we made last time. So here we might need to have oximeters and thermal guns, basic equipments, and some basic medicines will need to be kept there. We need to provide food to these people. So this is at different stages. I'm trying to kind of delineate as to at different levels what we need to do.
You spoke about fear earlier, you know, the sense of fear that the communities have around the disease. How strong is the anti-vaccine sentiment in rural India and in the communities where Pradhan works? And what is Pradhan and other NGOs? What are you all doing along with state and local governments to address concerns around vaccine hesitancy?
Hesitancy is very rampant. There is fear. As I said, the fear of the unknown, as it were. So the basis of everything is a fear, and fear arising from a lack of understanding. And that again resulting from lack of someone actually speaking to the people. There is a huge hesitancy on vaccines because they see people who are taking vaccines and still getting infected, and some of them getting infected seriously. I believe there's a lot of education that needs to happen around vaccine also. There is a protocol on when do you get your vaccine and then how do you take care of yourself in the early days after the vaccine. So there are so many things one needs to do, which nobody's telling them. So I think we need to really educate them. And as we know, there is the only way out. I mean, there is no option that you cannot take the vaccine. You have to take the vaccine. And we have to get everybody vaccinated. So we need to run as many campaigns and education programs as required. And we'll obviously need to ensure that vaccines are there. That is a big challenge in the country today, shortage of vaccines. But once these vaccines supply starts coming in more steadily, we'll need to work with the administration and arrange the vaccine centers as close to the villages as possible. And then maybe literally carry these people in batches to the vaccine center, get them vaccinated. Now, vaccinations are happening, but you know, it's also documented so shabbily. People don't, once you come back, they get a small piece of paper, very rough piece of paper in which they've written you're vaccinated. And on the other side, the name of the vaccine is also written, but it's also not very clear. Sometimes it's just written COV. Now, COV could be Covaxin or Covishield. Now, people do not know when you have to go to the next vaccine. A lot of people do not know what is the gap between the two. If it is Covaxin, it's 28 days. If it is Covishield, it is 12 weeks. So when does one go for the second dose? People are not very clear. There's a lot of confusion here at this stage. That is where I think the civil society need to get involved, work with the health system frontline workers and work with the health system in order to streamline the vaccine program, because that is the only way that we have. So we are seriously planning for that as well right now. Because one very important thing that we discovered is that the frontline workers, again, our frontline self-help group members, our own community cadre, then the health systems frontline workers, the Asha Didi and the Anganwadi workers, they are exposing themselves to a lot of risk. risk. So they need to be supplied with the basic protection kits, the PPE kits, the masks and sanitizers, etc. Because they need to travel from household to household, educating, doing surveillance, kind of listing the people who are showing symptoms, helping them along, meeting their expenses. Suppose they fall ill, some assurance we need to provide that, you know, your health expenses will be met with. And they also need to be therefore provided with insurance. So we are now talking to a couple of insurance companies also about providing insurance support to the frontline workers. So that is a very important support system we need to create, because currently they are our only road into the village to address these problems. Along with this, in addition to the isolation centers I spoke about earlier, in some of the district, we are talking to some of our donor partners if they can help us create what we call COVID care centers attached to a hospital. So basically augmenting the hospital capacity itself. So that will be a kind of more higher order kind of support to the health system itself. Once this COVID and the health part of the whole thing is taken care of, then we have to come and look at the general well-being of the community itself. There are a lot of people who are going hungry. In fact, the livelihoods is in a really bad shape as of now. This time, many of the heads of households have lost their lives. The bread earner is gone, or these households where the children have become orphans. So that is, I think, an important area where the government again needs to come in along with the NGOs to take care of these households. Livelihood rebuilding is an important agenda that we are seeing. After the last wave of the pandemic, the kind of shock the households had taken, the livelihoods are just gradually rebuilding.
Naren, would you like to share any data or research that may exist on what the plight of the rural communities is at this point in time?
There's a recent research done by Azim Premji University on the state of the rural economy right now, and special focus on employment. And the results have been, in a sense, in expected lines, but unfortunately not a very happy scenario. The livelihoods in the rural areas were just kind of beginning to pick up, as it were, because after the initial wave had waned, a lot of young people who had returned from the cities, many of them had gone back, but a lot of them had not gone back. About 10% of them continued to stay back because whatever they were doing had not restarted. And what had happened is they were kind of occupying the spaces in the villages, whatever employment opportunities that were in the village or self-employment opportunities. So women got mostly dropped out of any labor participation. So the employment for women has really suffered. Their own domestic employment responsibilities have increased. There's more drudgery. So the women have been particularly adversely affected because of the pandemic. After the second wave, obviously, the unemployment and underemployment rates have started increasing. And people have again started coming back into the villages. The situation is almost like we are back to where we were in last May. So therefore, we need to restart all the livelihoods rebuilding efforts that we had started last time in terms of trying to now lobby with the government in order to ensure some cash transfers happen. The MG Narega must get restarted so that they can get wages. And we also need to now immediately get to work in terms of helping the farmers sell their standing crop for a better price. Suddenly what has happened is because of the lockdown, the prices have crashed because there are not too many buyers, or there's not too much demand. So we need to now work with them to ensure marketing the crops and their produce so that they're able to go to the cities and sell them at a higher price that we're doing right now.
The scale of the problem is huge. And as you said, people were just beginning to bounce back from the adversities that they faced last year. And this is also during peak agricultural activity time. So they have been really, really impacted. What, according to you, are the five biggest challenges facing the communities you work with?
To talk about the challenges the communities have faced, not necessarily in the order of priority, but some important area. The first area is, as I was also earlier saying, there's a lot of lack of information on this whole pandemic as to what is happening. Lack of understanding, so which is also now leading to the fear. So these two are connected, but two important areas. Very little understanding on the disease, its symptoms, how to treat it locally, how to contain it locally, how we can avoid going to the hospital, etc. And because of lack of information, the fear, stigma, and all kinds of rumors. So this is a big area where a lot of information, a lot of education, a lot of training, and a lot of communication needs to happen. Another area I would say of importance is the flailing health infrastructure. So that is the big uncertainty regarding severe infections, because the infrastructure is just not equipped to respond. Obviously, the person will go to the hospital, may or may not get a bed. We saw stampedes in hospitals in big cities. I mean, forget the small towns or rural areas. So the abysmal infrastructure on health is a big problem. That is an unsurmountable problem, as it were. Then again, who is there in the village to talk to the people, to educate the people? So that the frontline staff, as I said, so this army needs to be strong, motivated, educated, and healthy. So how do you keep that? That will be very important.
How do you protect them?
How do you protect them, and how do you keep them healthy and excited and, let's say, confident? So that's very, very important. And the last but not least, I would say the total all-round collapse of livelihoods. So rebuilding livelihoods in its multiple aspects, that will be very important, which will include immediate pumping in of cash, I would say. Just transfer cash into the people's accounts, into their farmers' accounts, or into the women's account. Last time it happened, and this time the government has started in a very small manner, you know, a small amount of 2,000 rupees into the account of a few farmers. That has happened, but that's not enough. The amounts have to be much higher. And then last time there was this Janadhan transfer happened to women's accounts of 1,500 rupees. This time over, they need to do it again. Higher amounts would be required. There are people who are stranded in the villages. Again, the very sick and the old and disabled, etc. They need to be looked after. This time, there is an additional set of people, which I mentioned, families that have lost their head of households or children who have become orphaned. So that is another group of people that got added to the list this time. They need to be taken care of. We need to work with the government in order to get MG Narega restarted. And now the agriculture season is coming. How do we ensure that they have a good agriculture crop? Because that is what end of the day will see them through into the next wave, or forward, whenever that happens.
I'm aware that Pradhan and other NGOs are facing a massive funding gap in what their communities require and what the funding can cover. And just today in the morning, I read the story in Economic Times about the FCRA and the changes that were brought in last year. How is all of this impacting the funding and the work that needs to be done?
Yes. This time, there is an overall reduction in funding. Even though we keep hearing that a lot of people are willing to or wanting to provide help and support, but somehow many of that has not converted into actual funds in our account. If you actually compare it with last year at this stage of time, I think the amount of money we have been able to mobilize would be less than half of what we were able to do last time. Because last time, there were many organizations, many donors that came voluntarily and offered cash and financial support. We need to really raise resources. And this time the resources has to be of a much higher order also, because we're talking about supporting a very flailing health infrastructure in the rural areas. Having said that, the additional problem is the FCRA restrictions that have been put on civil society, which was kind of just imposed on us in the end of September last year, almost in the middle of the pandemic itself. But this time, this is actually restricting a lot of foreign aid that could have come. Because as I said, the local Indian resources are very limited. If this NGO sector could receive all the money that is getting promised from foreign sources, it would have really made a big difference. But it is not so, because one, a lot of donors on the other side are scared to deal with the FCRA complications here. Second, the restrictions themselves do not allow you to take money and then use it for purposes of this nature. Because one major impediment in the FCRA regulation is that you cannot receive bulk money and then retail it to, let's say, 10 smaller organizations who are working very close to the community. This has been a major impediment this time. So then similarly, the restrictions on your amount of administrative costs, etc. All the NGOs who are supposed to receive foreign money, they all are supposed to now open account in just one branch in New Delhi. And that branch is so overwhelmed that only about 20% of the people who apply have been able to open their account. So there are 80% NGOs who have FCRA registrations, but they don't have a valid bank account. So their own routine funding is also stopped, and any additional funding is also stopped. So this sector is in a real difficult shape. We are constantly talking to the authorities. We have written representations to the Prime Minister's office. There is even a case in the court right now. So we are hoping for some positive developments in the next couple of weeks so that, you know, we will be able to receive resources and then use it for the COVID response. Because unless you equip the NGOs, especially the NGOs who are close to the ground, you will not be able to deal with it effectively. We need presence of civil society organizations at the grassroots. And to do some effective work, we need resources. I mean, that is a reality. So yeah, something has to be done in order to help the NGOs.
A lot of constraints and challenges, actually, just in terms of funding and regulations. What is the one thing you would ask the private sector or individuals to do to help to make a difference?
I've listed down the various issues that we are facing. And what we are saying is that if you're able to somehow strengthen the hands of the NGOs, we will be able to take forward the work from there on. So some of the help that is forthcoming from the private sector now through CSR or through even private individuals, in-kind support in terms of oximeters, in terms of thermal guns, in terms of even oxygen concentrators. So that is a very positive thing that is happening. If that can happen in massive scale, that will be a big help. So equipping the rural isolation centers or rural facilities that we create with these kinds of equipment, that will be a very important step. Second area would be, as I said, financial support is so important because people who are in the field area, especially the frontline workers, they need to be paid, they need to be insured, their medical expenses will need to be met. So if funding can come, and the current situation, if Indian funding can come, it will be far, far more helpful. Third will be, in a sense, if they could use their good offices to work with our government and help in terms of policy change or postponement of these FCRA restrictions, that also will be a very important support. Then there will be a lot of help required subsequently in terms of rebuilding livelihoods. Private sector will need to come in big scale in order to create employment opportunities in the rural areas. So within, let's say, 100, 200 kilometers of the rural areas, if we can create as much economic opportunities through large-scale private investments, that will be a big support. Migration drains a lot of resources from these people.
What you are essentially saying is funding is required. The government needs to think about FCRA and probably putting it on the back burner for the time being so that it enables the flow of funds again, much needed funds to the sector and to the communities and to people on the ground. And creation of livelihoods once we have crossed this hurdle, this huge challenge that we are all facing. Thank you very much, Naren, for giving your time. I know you are incredibly busy at this point in time and working very hard with your people spread across in the hinterland. And these are frontline workers and you all are doing an incredible job. So thank you very much for giving an hour of your time.
Thank you so much, Sudha. I think this is an important initiative that you have taken because it is important to take these messages and the messages from the hinterland into the world outside also, because that is how we would one, spread the word, and second, also, you know, seek help and receive assistance as much as possible. So therefore, I think this is a very important task in itself. So I'm very glad that I got this opportunity to speak with you. So let's hope this results in some.
Absolutely. Let's hope that this call to action actually gets people, the private sector and individuals to actually come forward and donate towards supporting rural India during these difficult times. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sudha.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.